Got everything running. Okay. So I'll keep an eye on, in case we get more people joining us. You never know. Could happen. We've had a high of 3 participants now in this course during the online discussion. So it's getting better and better as we go along. So for those of you who are watching the video or listening on audio, this is the discussion session for Module 3 of Ethics Analytics, Duty of Care. I'm Stephen Downs. I'm joined by Sherita and Mark, who have been stalwart attendees throughout so far, and quite frankly have as much to do with authoring this course as I do, because without their contributions, this would be a very different looking course. Not really sure where to start. Did you guys? So there were 2 tasks in this week's edition, I guess, of the course. The first, and I saw a bunch of things that were added to add examples or links to the ethical issues. And actually, I found myself adding some ethical issues before even this particular discussion, because I've been doing the slides with the audio, which is taking me a lot longer than I thought it would. But that's okay, because I'm still getting good content out of it, at least to my mind. But I was doing the section on bad actors, and so part of what happens when I do these slides is I look up more resources, because I don't have enough already in my documentation, and I hit on a paper, let's see, what was it called? I've forgotten what it was called. Yeah, I have a good memory, but it doesn't last very long. List post. So this is what happens when you're not ready. It was called AI-Enabled Future Crime. It's from the journal Crime Science. And it's pretty comprehensive. So I'm putting a link to that article in today's newsletter, so you'll be able to see the link. And actually, so you don't have to wait, I'll put it right in the chat here. I quite liked the article. Now, a lot of the crime goes beyond the scope of this course, although, you know, pretty much any crime could fit into the scope of this course. So I wasn't sure really where to draw the line. But anyhow, there it is in the chat. But I did like it, and so I thought I'd share. So, and I'll be doing that throughout, the course, adding more posts to the newsletter that I find interesting. And if you guys find anything that you think I should share, send me a note, and because there are good resources and resources that aren't necessarily appearing in the newsletter. So, did you find anything of interest in adding the examples to the issues?
Well, I did. I found it quite interesting. I found I was going down a rabbit hole because there are so many things that can pop up. You know, even on page 1,
yeah,
if you're searching. The last thing that I put in, which is just a few minutes ago, was under anonymity and the Tor browser.
Hmm.
Now, I've used Tor before, for whatever.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting was, when I thought about it, I thought about good possibilities for Tor.
Yeah.
And then I thought about bad possibilities. and, you know, the gray area in between, such as, pirating a movie,
mm-hmm.
right, where you can protect yourself using a number of ways, not that I've ever done that, but, so I found that really, really interesting, so yeah. I thought, okay, I'm going to go down all of these things and get lost down a rabbit hole. It's fun.
Yeah, that keeps happening to me. Like, I couldn't turn down reading and studying this crime studies thing.
Really? That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it was pretty good. How about you, Mark?
I'm good. Yeah, I have that same rabbit hole problem.
Yeah.
but this week I spent most of my time in a different rabbit hole. I did add some resources, but I haven't gotten to the linking part. And that's fine, because I'm sort of laying back. I read a couple of Matthias posts. I think it's hard to pronounce his name.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to wrap my head around, I get the concept of the linking, but the doing of it and the purpose of the doing of it and doing it purposefully. So that's kind of on hold there. I'm in another standard online college class. This week got completely sucked up by that class,
mm-hmm.
Which is unusual, but it was a good week. It was one of those kind of open weeks, do kind of what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, that ruined my week because I...
Yeah. So how did this course compare with that course? What was your experience? And I know this is a much smaller course, but I mean, just generically.
Yeah, so this is actually one of my areas of study is online education, mm-hmm. and particularly learning management systems. I'm actually certified in three of them. And this college, Metropolitan State University in Minneapolis, Minnesota, uses a fourth one, Pearson's Brightspace B2L, which is not the best system. And then they don't support their teachers, even though my teacher is tenured faculty. She's not been properly trained.
Mm-hmm.
Hope she never sees this. I like her a lot, and... to compare, navigating your course is no more difficult than navigating hers. And that doesn't mean you're easy to navigate. But she's probably the most expensive, formerly most widely used system. So in my mind, as a student, I should be able to just click forward.
Yeah.
And just work through the material. She posts a video, she posts an explanation. You might need to jump out for a rubric or something, but I should be able to just click through each week.
Yeah.
And not. And so it's actually structured quite a bit like yours, in that you have to keep returning to the beginning to then branch from there. And, which is fine. I mean, that's standard. But from a user experience, and I always look at it from the student user experience,
yeah.
And I've actually yet to experience a course where you could just click straight through the course. Some courses sort of break it into pieces where you can get on a roll and click through the material, but never through 14 weeks. And that to me is, it's an ideal, it's probably undoable, but to me that's how a course should potentially be structured. One advantage your course has is one of two I see is, first of all, of course, there's more agency.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has equal agency, and that's an ideal that higher education has been stumbling to yet. There are certain exceptions, but as you, you know exactly who's talking about. We can name the four or five people
yeah.
that are talking about this, North American higher education. And then, of course, I lost my thought there. Oh, and your course does not hide where the courses go. And this is my biggest complaint with most online courses.
Oh, yeah.
They insist on putting each week's module up at a certain time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not too great. You know, because sometimes we get behind, sometimes yep. we have an opportunity to get ahead. You know, life is not in the metered time signature.
Yeah. Yeah, in the case of this course, if it's not up yet, it's because it doesn't exist yet.
Yeah. No, but I mean, but anybody can click in and see where we're heading.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
if the content is in there.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, again, because we're co-constructing it, of course the content is there.
Yeah.
But at least the map is there.
Yeah.
And in this other course I'm in, and in most college online courses, they refuse to show you the map. I don't know.
That's strange. Yeah.
Especially because they're accredited. So, I mean, you know how you want to know where the course is going. You
can yeah.
check the accreditation and the course listing in the faculty, in the catalog that the faculty has to look at.
Yeah.
But who, how many students even know about that?
No.
I mean, only because of years spent in shared governance, and I didn't even know that exists.
Yeah. Yeah, particularly what I would respond to is you're saying that the person who's teaching the course, you know, is tenured, yet that person may not have had very much training on how to put a course together mm-hmm. and or how to teach online. And yeah. this is very prevalent in university. I mean, even back it up, when you teach in a university, who taught you to be a teacher?
Yeah.
No one.
No one. Yeah.
So.
Can I tell a really short story?
Go for it.
One of the biggest revelations of my college career, returning after the Great Recession of 2008, was in a shared governance meeting where the chancellor and the faculty were going at it. It was a four-campus community college district, so we had a chancellor and a college president and a faculty senate meeting, I believe. And the chancellor, who had taught in that system in previous decades and then left and got his EDD and come back, was in this confrontation with a faculty, a radical faculty member. And the chancellor said to this member, unlike you all, I have a teaching student. And I looked at the faculty member next to me and gave him an elbow. I said, what's he talking about? And they said, oh, well, teachers don't. They don't teach us how to teach. We're subject matter experts. And I was just like, you're kidding. You mean kindergarten teachers have a teaching certificate, but you don't?
Mm-hmm.
Like, look. That was a revelation.
And it's an issue that's been raised before by, for example, Tony Bates, who has argued at length that all college and university professors should have, you know, required courses in how to teach, ideally as part of their PhD. I have mixed feelings about that, because... You know, somebody becomes a professor of physics, not so much because they want to teach physics, but because they want to do physics research. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it sort of goes against, you know, good pedagogy to force somebody to learn something they don't want to learn, at least to my mind. I know, even though it's a requirement of the job, that they actually know how to do this sort of stuff. So I'm of mixed feelings on that.
On the other hand, as a consumer of higher education, I would wonder why there wouldn't be a practicum included before setting a researcher loose in a classroom. You don't let doctors come out of the classroom and into the operating room. You know, or airline pilots out of the simulator and into the cockpit. And I would argue that teaching is an equally serious, professional job.
Yeah. I'm thinking, though, that a professor, a researcher in some subject probably ought to be viewed as a resource rather than as the designer of learning, because they're not going to pick up how to do it in just a few courses anyways. You know, I think the analogy might be, you know, we don't want aircraft engineers to pilot aircraft, not because they haven't been trained in how to pilot aircraft, but because really that's not what they do. They design aircraft, they don't pilot them, we have separate people to pilot them. And these separate people need to know something about the airplane, but they don't need to know how to build one. How's that for an analogy? Is that working?
Yeah, well, it reminds me of it's probably apocryphal, but apparently you used to have to be able to build a car to get a driver's license in Russia. I still don't believe that was true, but that was the story in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
That in the Soviet Union, you had to demonstrate mechanical capabilities before getting a driver's license.
I could believe that part of it, the mechanical capabilities part, because they didn't want you abandoning the car in the middle of the road just because you couldn't fix it.
I think what you just said, though, points to my abandoned favorite word, because you can only, you know, use a favorite word so much, the affordance of digital education.
Yeah.
It is that, and this refers to our conversation earlier in the week, team, that if you have a learning technologist, a learning designer,
mm-hmm.
working in tandem with a subject matter expert,
yeah.
then you're going to get a good course.
Yeah.
The students are going to get the better learning outcome. The institution is going to have a better reputation. You know, you have a better product,
yeah.
a better reputation, and then a better enrollment, blah, 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 blah. So I think we're headed in that direction, except for the resources.
Right? Yeah. I think that's probably true. Yeah.
But that's the main thing. And yet, now that we've hired, you know, 10 times the administrators that we used to be 3 decades ago, those people should be looking at cutting costs in other ways than reducing faculty to find the resources, cutting themselves out, and putting those resources to increase support for faculty.
So the holy grail, to bring us back to our topic, of all of this is supposed to be artificial intelligence. But it's not obvious that this is easily possible. It's interesting, one of the bad actor things that I was doing just before this session was misrepresentation. Where you have a snake oil salesman basically coming along and saying, AI can do all this, and you should invest in it. And, you know, I can think of some of these LMS systems that bought into some of these AI systems and made their inventors rich, but didn't really add very much capacity to their LMS. That bothers me. So... But it's interesting.
Your holy grail of characterization makes me think by adding AI to a learning designer and a subject matter expert, you would have an infinity.
Yeah.
distance education. So, particular distance education,
yeah. Right,
where people are not gathering in a room or around the fire, but are mediated. That perhaps those three elements would be the best.
I would be interested in the debate between those three elements.
Mm.
Because each of those elements, in a way, has a different purpose.
Yeah.
A different lens on how they see the task. Here I am referring to a artificial intelligence, as an entity.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But it's okay, it's 2021, you can do that.
Yeah. You know, that entity has a perspective and a lens.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, instructional designer has a perspective and a lens. They may never have taught anybody anything. And that comes out when they try to teach the subject expert how to use the technology. So I'd love to see the debate. I think it would be a great triumvirate.
Yeah.
But the debate would be really interesting. You know, the learning designer may say, no, we don't need that. We don't need that. We can make this happen like this.
Mm-hmm.
And AI may say, but I can predict that X will happen. And, you know, the teacher or the prof might say, you have no idea where I could go with this.
Yeah.
But if it was networked, interactive, and with feedback loops, I think that Trinity could really create a new way of teaching and learning.
I think it would be extremely interesting.
I would advocate for another piece is to put the students in there, too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so then that would be the quadraphonic learning environment.
Oh, yes.
It's now the young holy trinity.
Yeah.
Exactly. Perfect. Yeah. And then to be able to hold that, you know, and that's what an institution is for, right? So maybe an institution isn't, primary focus isn't mowing the lawns and keeping the pool clean. Maybe the institution's primary purpose should be to hold a space where something like this could assemble, reflect, improve, grow, you know.
So, do you want the AI to be a participant in the discussion or a mediator?
Ah, that's a good question. Can we have two? Can we have two? One's a moderator, okay, and one is a discussant.
Hey Siri, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, and I just have a flash of irrelevant responses coming from Siri. The temperature today is 14.
Yeah.
But then what's in the backgrounding, back something, whatever it is that the AI does to improve its responses.
Yeah.
Just reading about that this morning.
The other thing, and this is part of the reason why I'm doing everything in this course, even though it's stupid, is actually making the decisions. When you have multiple people, having a say, and I've worked with teams, both of developers and instructors and all of that, and here I am putting on my professor hat, even though I'm not one. You know, I've got a pretty good idea where I want this to go. And most of my experience working with these teams is failing to convince them that it should go in that direction. And now I can imagine having to argue with an AI it should go in that direction. And being overruled. Yeah.
Well, there might have to be some rules in the teams.
Yeah.
But there are plenty of existing rules in education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, back to accreditation and course, as professors or people who play them on YouTube, you know, I can't think of the name of that document that an instructor has to conform to, the document that was submitted for accreditation of that course. There's a name I can't think of.
Transcript?
All accredited courses have to claim that they conform to the intentions and the outcomes in the accreditation document of that course. And
I never did that.
I never did that.
Interesting. Well, yes, because by the time a faculty member is assigned a course, that's forgotten about.
Yeah.
But it exists. It's in that space between the institution and the
funding
agents. It's in that space. And professors, never educated about that part of the system. And, of course, they would use this, the suggestion that their course conform to it.
Yeah.
But the administration has to be able to defend that. If questions about accreditation, I've been in some accreditation, I'm in one right now.
My experience is that I developed 4 courses from scratch. And I had to put in certain things, like you can't have, all the grades happening at the end. You can't have something 100%. You know, the really little itsy bit pieces. You provide a syllabus the first time you do it. You'll always change that. And you put all of this stuff in to, an advisory committee, and they rubber stamp it. Correct.
Yeah. I know. See, I learned these things through shared governance and endless meetings.
Yeah.
As a student representative.
Yeah.
And I had the time, and most students don't. But it was interesting. And it occurs to me also, I'm American, you are both Canadian, right?
Right.
And so I'm speaking about an American experience in California.
Right.
So that's a particular accreditation agency in a particular state.
Yeah.
So I realize that. But I'm guessing that if you keep that around, because your institutions are also accredited, but I'm not aware of how your accreditation agencies are structured, if they're different or the same. As we have regional accreditation agencies.
Yeah.
I think we do too.
I imagine a provincial.
Yeah.
Yes.
And also, there are a couple of now federally approved, since the federal government has gotten into education. Only since the first Bush presidency. Before that, the federal government was completely out of education. But they have become involved, and so there are a couple now of national, which are particularly handy for online.
I think it can be a good thing, and I think it can be a bad thing. Because once you get the rules and accreditation rules too tight, then your ability to change your course or to do something totally radical, like, I'm not going to grade. I'm not going to, what I'm going to do is I'm going to offer you all an A. And people who really move forward, well, you get the A plus. You're not allowed to do that.
No.
You're not allowed to write that down. But I did it. An accreditation would basically tell me, no, you're not allowed.
Yeah.
Yet, that is a better pedagogy than having, flash tests, blah, blah. It's a much better.
Clickers. Oh, those things. That one, right?
It has gone everywhere.
That's in my experience. That's...
So again, that's a bad thing and a good thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, imagine...
It pointed to the tension between what we're doing, which has no rules.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the potential over-instruction situation, which is basically how it's operating these days, especially with these top-level administrations and all the tasks and rulings and reports. Data. And so what we're searching for, I think, is a middle way. that allows more agency, more creativity, and yet, you know, offer some structure so that when you move from, so when I move from this class to a different, completely unstructured class, the overlap is going to be very small.
Right.
Right. And so what we're searching for, I think, here is some sort of open framework that a participant, whether they're a subject matter expert or not, can anticipate the way the next course will go based on just this loose thing rather than a highly structured.
I mean, in my ideal world, we wouldn't actually divide all of this by courses anyways. It would just be the professors would be participating in this overall giant graph, and then people who are studying that would just go from place to place on that graph. And there might be events happening at different times and so on, but you know, you wouldn't be locked into a series of events or anything like that. I don't know if that would be better, but that's kind of what I would prefer. But then I really fall on the no rule side of things, so.
The other thing that I would say, although again this is a bit off topic, is that teaching young children and then high school and then adults is really, really different in terms of how people approach what they learn, how they learn, etc. Once you get into adults who are doing this because they have an interest, because they need a specific skill, because they need an answer for something that they're interested in, you have a totally different student. And one where I think the more open way of doing things is really better, because you know, adults learn what they want to learn, right? I mean,
and they don't learn what they don't want to learn.
No, they don't.
And they can be really stubborn about it.
I still have some mandatory courses that NRC wants me to take. And they're only half-hour courses, but they've been sitting in the hopper for several months now.
Proving my point.
Yeah.
So I use three different words for these different types of learners, and I promote the last one. I'll get to it in a second. But it hasn't caught on yet. But anyway, so you have pedagogy. And that's developmental learning. I mean, that's a perfect word for it. And whether it takes 6 years or 8 years or 12 years, there's some discussion around that. I hearken back to, I'm old, my parents were old when they had me, and their parents were old when they had them. So back to my grandparents had very little education, formal education. They weren't stupid. They weren't ignorant. They weren't uneducated. So, you know, their case can't be made that we have almost too much education in some. But anyway, that's pedagogy. Then there's andragogy, adult learning. But, you know, that's more task-oriented, that's more careerist.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I mean, it's a long literature, you know, it's almost 100 years old.
No. You have to, in that, put also, I don't have a word for it, but it's not everybody's interested in that skill. Not everybody is interested in learning something for a career.
Mm-hmm.
What happens with adults is they're often interested in learning something just because they're interested in learning something, or they wouldn't be there. And
that's
you have that word. What is it?
It comes from Australia.
Yeah.
And it's only probably 20 years old, so it's a brand new word. Podagogy.
Yeah.
Yes, I've seen that. Yes.
And that is the self-directed adult learning.
Yeah.
And that's different than the andragogy. And andragogy is a category. And that's that's your adult learning classes, your second language classes, at Dyke and high schools. And it's a perfectly good category. In fact, I think that the modern university has somehow slipped out of pedagogy and into andragogy and multi-admit it. But then there's hobbyology, and I think that's a great word, because it's self-directed is the first part of that. Self-directed. And that's the part that can be open and creative and craft.
So how would AI fit into that?
So, yeah, that's the question I've been thinking of as this conversation has continued.
Yeah, so how would it fit into that?
So, let's go all the way back, because I was going to ask way back when we were early in this discussion, talking about accreditation and all of that. Imagine we had AIs that monitored the courses and decided that they should be accredited or not accredited, depending on how they were being conducted. What are your thoughts on that?
Who programmed the AI? Is my first question.
Mm-hmm.
And who does it report to?
Mm-hmm.
What if, another example I love to bring up amongst educators is the Edinburgh University Student Union.
Yeah.
It's an actual union.
Okay.
It's 200 years old. And they own their own building on campus. They have their own funding, their own building, their own rules. And if the university crosses them, things happen.
Yeah.
Real consequences happen. They also started the Fringe Festival, by the way.
Started the what?
The Fringe Festival.
Oh, the Fringe, okay. Yeah.
In the world. That came out of that independent student union. So if they own the AI, if they program the AI,
there we go.
It will be a very different AI than one purchased from a corporation by the
university.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly.
And then missing from that conversation, unfortunately, in this case, at least in the United States, is the faculty union.
Yeah.
They used to run universities. They no longer do.
No, and that's true, I think, increasingly around the world.
It looks like it to me, but
yeah.
I'm here. I'm not going.
Yeah, and that's, you see a lot of these applications of AI in learning directed toward leading people to specific outcomes, usually outcomes related to employment objectives that are determined by, basically a mixture of people in the community who hire people and university administrations and politicians. And it seems to me that that raises the issue of whether that really is the appropriate way to use an AI in learning. I don't know if I have it down as one of my issues yet, but you know, just the idea of using the AI to direct people toward a certain end in a system where really we'd like to promote autonomy of some sort, especially at the higher levels.
Yeah, it seems like we're evolving even more towards the German model of sorting people into careers as early as possible, which used to be existing, at least in California.
Yeah. It's almost like
that makes me wonder, could we have three competing AIs?
We might.
Now we're six.
Now we're six. Yeah.
But it comes back down to a discussion or a debate or it would even be a discussion or debate as to what would the benefit be to any of those entities.
Yeah.
And there would be some kind of tension there. There would have to be some kind of tension there.
Yeah, I would say that it comes down to governance. It's who decides, and it would be an ongoing debate, hopefully annual reviews, updated.
Oh, and does the AI do the annual reviews?
they can submit theirs too, yeah. theirs would be, you know, more detailed and very long. And the students, I would hope, would be the most critical, and the faculty would hopefully be the most on point, you would hope, on what's needed, what improvements are needed. And then the administrators, you know, they have to keep their eye on the budget. I mean, that is their job, so it's part of it. So it would be an interesting mix. It would be an interesting meeting. I guess you'd have to color code the speakers of your guy. If they sit on the table top. I don't know. We're going to find out about the maybe meeting. But people will eventually find out how this sets up.
The risk here, and it actually shows up in one of the issues that I was writing about and talking about this week, is that when you let the AI make decisions, now of course there's always the requirement to have, as they say, humans in the loop to, you know, affirm the judgment that the AI makes. But what happens is that it becomes kind of a rubber stamp thing. And sure, you have the meeting, but you generally tend to defer to the AI because, you know, it's done all of that work. And you probably can't outsmart it, so you just rubber stamp it. And it ends up being the AI making all the decisions anyways.
Yeah, that's that black box problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the black box. Of course this machine is smarter than me.
Yeah. Ever try to argue with an ATM?
So perhaps that's the new human purpose.
Yeah, to argue with machines.
Monitor the machines.
Yes.
I keep coming back to what you said just a few moments ago, and that had to do with power.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the power, right? And that's that could be a real slippery slope.
Yeah.
When you're dealing with, you know, AI, that could be a real slippery slope. And would AI be more? Would AI have more of an affinity with more dictators, right? People
mm-hmm.
who ask total control. Okay, I don't know that anybody can do that, but whatever.
Yeah.
So would AI have an affinity for that?
Well, that's a good question.
It seems to.
Yeah.
But again, the AI that we've interacted with were built by corporations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Who are hierarchical and concerned with power.
Yeah.
Primarily.
And one could even say that they, certain of those corporations, have the power because they can also very easily influence legislature.
Imagine the only tool we had
on our government.
Imagine the only tool we had, sorry, Mark, was the Facebook algorithm for choosing what we hear, what we can say.
Yes.
I think that points to the multiple algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
And then back to power, multiple centers of power. And here I go being American, but dividing power across three or four sections. Not the best way to govern, but perhaps one way to make sure power is not centralized.
Of course, the final end result of that is stalemate.
Yeah, we're living that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you're not the first to live that either. In ancient Rome, they had clubs that were designated by color, red, blue, green, and I think the other one was yellow. They eventually broke down into two factions. I believe they were blue and green. And they would have pitched battles in the streets of Rome. And they, you know, the only thing is, like, they weren't political agencies particularly, but you know, so they were sort of like glorified fan clubs. But the thing is, over time, what happened is all the balanced competition ended up as being like perfectly even, and it all boiled down to just two sides. It didn't matter how many you started with. You ended up at two. And they were perfectly balanced, and you could never get a resolution. Or you know, the stalemate in World War I before new technology emerged, when you had two sides that were perfectly balanced, you know, and you couldn't get a resolution. And that's what happens. You know, it's good to have checks and balances, but when they're equal, over time, they progress to a point where you can't get past a disagreement. The U.S. has three. So in principle, two could always outvote the third, but that's not really how it's worked out. Because the three checks and balances have now become irrelevant. The major political agencies in the U.S. are the two political parties. And these three areas just become the arena in which those two political parties fight against each other. And again, never reach a resolution. That's my observation anyways. And it's a problem in AI too. You have competitive, like there are neural networks, which are competitive pools, right? And you get your input into the system, and then you allocate that system into different pools of neurons, and they each do their own thing, and then they come back together and fight it out, right? And in one case, and that's I have the example of a duck rabbit in one of the slides. In one case, the competitive pool just simply swamps out all other opposition. We might think of that as, you know, being similar to how the U.S. reacted to communism, right? No, you can't have that, period. We'll move this way. Or, you know. Or, alternatively, you get a case where the AI can't make a resolution. Can't decide between duck or rabbit, and can't do anything. So it's a design issue, and it's, you know, it's a design issue in society, and it's also a design issue, I think, in AI. And it's not clear to me that the methods of resolving it are good methods of resolving it. And they might be, but.
What would be a method of resolving it in terms of AI?
That's a good question. I would almost say not trying to resolve it, if I had to answer that. I mean, I think the problem happens when you try to force the AI into rule-like behavior. Pick one alternative or the other. Pick Republican or Democrat. Pick duck or rabbit. And all of these problems are so complex that one or the other is never going to be the correct answer. And sometimes Sorry?
What about a new species? Yeah. It's not a duck or a rabbit.
Yeah, that's just called getting it wrong. Yeah.
Oh, you're getting on dangerous territory there.
Yeah, yeah.
I was reading this morning about early AI not being able to distinguish between men and women.
Yeah.
Article about Minsky and Papert. And apparently that's been solved. But then this brings me back to human agency.
Yeah.
Because I really do believe in human agency and creativity. Because now we have people who facial recognition will not be able to sort.
Yeah.
Male and female. Yeah. It's just, they have figured out a way to present themselves in a way that is not binary. And I don't know about you, I've run into them online all the time.
Yeah.
And so there's the creative response to the demand to binary conformity that AI might require.
Yeah.
The humans are like, nope, we'll figure out a way out. It's, I love the term Wiccan problems.
Yeah.
And that's where this force is inside of the Wiccan problem.
Yeah.
There will be no resolution, there will be no solution, there will just be exploration and building this graph and seeing what that suggests, yeah. And then a new iteration next year.
And that's why we're building that graph. I have two things just to bring us to a close. The first thing came up in my thinking as we talked about this. It's almost like contemporary applications of AI in learning are attempting to replicate what Plato proposes in the Republic, where all of your attributes are identified by, in Plato's case, a philosopher king, in our case, an AI, and then you are placed into the right role in society, and that is your role, and that is your lot in life. There have been a lot of objections to the Republic, as you can imagine, and I think similar objections come up when we try to use AI in that way in order to sort and catalog and categorize and allocate people to their places. Second thing, I just wanted to open briefly the graph exercise, and this is more for the people watching the video than for you guys, but but I think it'll still be useful to you as well. So I just want to show how it works.
That's what I've been waiting for.
Okay, good. So it is useful.
Or I plunge in and mock it all up.
You can't. This is something you can't break. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Yeah. So. Okay, so let's go. You should be looking at, sorry, I'm bouncing around a bit here because the stupid sharing thing covers over my tabs. There we go. Right. Okay, you should be seeing the Ethics, Analytics, and Duty of Care screen right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
Yes.
So I'm going to go to Ethical Issues, and I'm going to go to the appropriate task, so add to the graph, and we'll access, I didn't have to make that extra click, but to access the graph tool, click here. And so here it is, ignore these. I need to take them off, but the way I load the graph right now, that's how it works. So this is more than I wanted to put in a single instance of the graph. I'm just working with a default file for now, and I'll change up this display a bit. But the idea here is that we're looking at these applications that are on the left, and then these ethical issues that are on the right. And the idea is to ask yourself, what applications raise what ethical issues? And so if you think, for example, suppose you think that dashboards raise the issue of content manipulation. Actually, they probably don't, but let's say you did, right? So just click on dashboards, and the description comes up in the right in case you need to refresh yourself. Then press the Alt key, and then click your mouse and drag. And then once you've reached the other point, unclick, and you've drawn a line. That's tricky because I always want to just drag, and that's what happens to me. I will probably change that once I figure out how, so you just drag the line. But right now, if you just click and drag, you end up moving the thing. And I'll probably flip those, so you have to do Alt-click to move the box, but just click and drag. But right now, that's how it works. So just draw your lines. So we've got dashboard to content manipulation, plagiarism detection to fear and anxiety. I think that is a real one. Plagiarism detection to privacy generally. Yeah, I think that's one. So in the future, I'll just have a few on the left-hand side and a few on the right-hand side, so you're not facing this overwhelming, graph of 100 different elements on each side. So once you're done that, you're happy with the graph as you've drawn it, right-click. And that pops up this. Now there is this, you can add a new item. It will save the new item in the information that it sends to the server, but I don't do anything with that. You can also wipe it clean, but then all you've done is wiped it clean. The real thing you want to do is click export. Click export, and the system will take care of the rest for you. It'll tell you your graph was submitted successfully, and it'll list things that you've added. Click OK, and you're done. It'll take you back to the task. So that's how it works. Now, the way this is going to work, now right now, what it does is it saves what you've done and adds it to the end of a file of links that I'm just building up. But this file of links will be fed back in to the system so that when you click on, let's go back to applications of learning analytics, and we can look at each of these applications. So all applications. So let's pick one, plagiarism detection, I think was the one we were using. So right now, we don't even have any articles. I thought I had an article in there. I guess not. In addition to articles and links, there would be another section underneath that would list the ethical issues that were raised. And it's not just me defining what issues are raised by plagiarism detection. It's all the participants in the course who are defining that, right? And so that builds this interrelationship so that you can explore this issue, you can explore the other factors around this issue. And as an aside, that's really why you can't, I mean, we could, in this course, you could have it go from the beginning all the way through to the end. Theoretically, that's doable, and I've done that with some of these next previous things. But because we're building this as a graph, it's the sort of thing where you can just wander through the graph. There is no one path through the graph, although what I'd like to do is create more range of different paths so you can experience this differently, or maybe do something like a click capture or whatever, so that you can go through the course and then the way you went through the course becomes a path for someone else, something like that. The graph that is created, in this case between the application and the ethical issue, that might be selected once, it might be selected 100 times by different people. And that gives us the possibility of each connection, each link between things as having a weight. And so we can use that in order to highlight the issues that are being selected the most often. And you know, if we wanted to highlight parts of the course, or even just highlight the display here, we'd say, you know, well, pick maybe the five ethical issues that got the most links here, and that allows us to focus in on those. So that's how it works, and that's what it's intended to do. It's intended to be very easy for you guys, but very powerful. Mark?
Yeah, so just for my own clarification,
yeah.
The reason you said we can't break it is because you're aggregating
yeah.
these separate graphs, right?
Yeah.
So I just want to be clear about that. And then the white clicker, does that just clear the connections you made, or does that clear the entire graph?
That'll clear the whole graph, and then you'd have to reload it. Yeah, nothing permanent happens to wipe clear. Now, I think, let me just check this. We'll go back to the activity. Whoops.
So what we're doing is we're pulling a copy.
Yeah.
The module 2, wherever it is, yeah. anyway, that copy, we're pulling that copy,
yeah.
modifying it, and submitting it to the aggregate.
That's right, yeah. This is just a copy. Doesn't matter what you do to this. So, like, let's wipe it clean. So that's all you've done. But now, if I reload the page, so I'm reloading it here, and there it is again. Also, I think, let me just check, I'll draw a line here, click on the line, all you can do there is change color. I'd love to add a delete to that, but I don't think there is a delete at the moment. No, there isn't, it's just change color. And even that doesn't work very well. Okay, so that's too bad. But, you know, it'd be nice to have an edit or delete on this. It's not a huge thing, but it's certainly doable. It's just figuring out how to write the code. Go ahead.
Yeah, and did you ever figure out a way to zoom in and out?
No.
It's all on one, you know.
Whoops. Rats. I did not. Yeah. That's a really good point.
We talked about that somewhere. I think it was on Monday.
I did. Yeah.
Can you message Matthias or whoever?
I'll ask Matthias if he knows, because it seems to me there is a way. Whoops, I keep...
Yeah, so you can see the whole thing and zoom in and the connections and then pull
that. Yeah. That would be a lot better, for sure. I mean, you know, does this help, maybe?
I don't think so. I think I tried that.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and all it does is load this intro game. Well, move pan, drop input, add single items, wipe, export, recolor, drag. Yeah, I don't see anything that says change the size.
Yeah, well, yeah, pan is side to side.
Yeah.
Zoom, what we're looking for is a zoom.
Yeah, move, connect, drag, alt plus drag, right, port, recolor, wipe, add single items, no, yeah, click this and look for me, okay. Yeah, so I don't see anything for scale. And knowing how this works on the back end, that could be a bit difficult. Because it uses the web canvas element, and so each one of these boxes is defined with an XY location, and so to zoom it in or out, you'd have to change all of those XY locations and resize the box. Now, it's a computer, it could do that, but writing the software, if that software doesn't exist to do that, writing that software would be a bit tricky. Yeah. I'm not sure how tricky, but it would be, you know, I could easily figure out how to make the boxes bigger and smaller.
So if you could paint Matthias about that, I'll ask him.
There may be a way. If not, I'll just make sure all of our graphs fit inside the box. And then you can change the size of a web page by clicking on Control and using your mouse to scroll, which works pretty well.
Size of the display, but you're still only seeing that one
part. You're still only seeing that one part, yeah. And then if you scroll it too big, now you're sort of in trouble. But yeah, you can't see the whole graph if the graph is bigger than the box. That's the problem. So I hope that helped. And I hope that this is an easy but interesting exercise. That was the intent anyways. And something different that you don't normally do in a course. So, any final words before we wrap up the module on ethical issues? Okay.
I'll just go back down the rabbit hole.
So there's going to be lots of rabbit holes in the next module. We're looking at ethical codes, and you guys will be able to benefit by me having gone down a rabbit hole and dug up dozens and dozens and dozens of ethical codes and having run them through an analysis. And, So that'll be a bit of fun, I think. But we'll talk about that starting on Monday.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to wrap up. Only 9 minutes late. That's not too bad. see you all next week, and have a good weekend.
You too.
Thanks. Bye, everyone. Bye.